Hi, I'm Jane Lindholm. I'm the host of Vermont Edition, and I just wanted to let you know that this podcast has been edited for brevity. Thanks for listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. There's no question that the COVID-19 pandemic has had a significant impact on the Vermont economy. In just the last 3 months, almost 40% of the state's entire workforce has filed for unemployment benefits. A lot of smaller businesses were forced to close down, including many in the tourist and service industries. The Vermont Commission on Women has just released a new report about this economic downturn, and it concludes that the pandemic has had a disproportional impact on women in the state. In many ways, these conditions highlight many of the existing economic disparities between men and women in Vermont. Well, with us today to talk about the details of this report are Carrie Brown, who is the executive director of the Vermont Commission on Women, and also with us, Emily Kornheiser, who is a member of the commission. She is also a state representative from Brattleboro. Great to have you both on the program today. Thanks for taking the time to be with us.
Thank you for having us.
Great to be here.
Carrie, the report clearly shows that the COVID-19 pandemic has adversely affected more women than men in Vermont, both from an economic perspective and a healthcare perspective. So let's just start with the economic side of this equation. One of the major factors why this is happening seems to be that more women are likely to be employed in the types of businesses that were hit hardest by the pandemic. Explain that to us.
Yes. Yeah, so before the pandemic started, we saw disproportional representation in areas such as childcare workers, other personal care workers, healthcare workers, nurses. 91% of the nurses in Vermont are women. 82% of other healthcare workers are women, and 82% of personal care workers, which includes child care workers as well as home health workers, that sort of thing, are women. And so these are jobs that were absolutely essential. And so we see a lot of women in essential positions and having to stay in them. And then at the other side of the coin is that we've got a lot of women in retail, food service, hospitality, the jobs that completely went away for a time and which are likely to be very slow to come back. So, for instance, 81% of all tipped wage workers in Vermont are women, which is the highest in the country.
That's an amazing statistic. Can you explain that to me? Why do you think that's true and what does it encompass?
Well, so that is people who work in restaurants, wait staff. It also could be people who work in housekeeping and hotels and other jobs that rely on tips. And so they have a lower minimum wage, and they're more likely to be on the front lines of those whose jobs were laid off when the pandemic began. And so these are jobs that are generally not very well paid to begin with. So before this even started, of course, we saw a wage gap between men and women in Vermont of 16%. And that had a lot to do with the kinds of jobs that women were doing, tend to be lower paid, more likely to be part-time. And so they're much more impacted when those jobs close down. And then we're also concerned about the long-range impact because there's not going to be a quick comeback for restaurants or other hospitality jobs. And so women are going to continue to be feeling the brunt of that.
And you mentioned that Vermont has the highest rate in the nation of women who make up the so-called tipped wage job force. Why do you think that's true?
Well, that is a really good question. I don't know that I have any theories about why that is true. It probably has a lot to do with the availability of jobs in general in our economy and the kind of jobs that are open. We recently released another report based on our listening project where we did conversations around the state and an online survey of about 2,200 people. And one of the things we heard over and over again was the difficulty of finding good jobs, jobs with benefits, jobs that pay well, jobs with flexibility. And so I think, you know, we have an underlying issue here for employment of women in Vermont.
Emily, as Carrie just mentioned to us, women make up 82% of the personal care industry in Vermont. This also includes child care professionals. So the closing of child care centers, when we went to the Stay Home, Stay Safe executive order from Governor Scott, and all but the essential workers and having child care were closed down, this seemed to have a double whammy. First of all, a lot of women lost their jobs.
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of women lost their jobs. Those jobs were primarily held by women. And so those women lost their jobs, had to file for unemployment. We know how incredibly difficult that process went for a number of people and how hard it was to access benefits. And then simultaneously, we know that when there is a problem with childcare or caregiving in general in a household, that women are much more likely to step back from the workforce to provide that caregiving. And so we saw more women beginning to work from home to care for their kids simultaneously. And that can both mean a loss in jobs or mean just less productivity on the job, which sets people up worse for future advancement. One example that I've really appreciated, because we talk about this across the economic spectrum, the impacts that we see, we can talk about food service workers and the low wages there, but we can also talk about academia. And so in academia, we're seeing a loss of jobs for adjuncts, which are much more likely to be women. And then we're also seeing that women who are working from home in academia are less likely to publish right now. And so I think that's a really useful example for understanding what it means that as professional folks are working from home and caregiving simultaneously, the different impacts that has on people in the household, and that women are more likely to give up work hours to provide that care.
I was going to say, not only did a lot of women lose their jobs because the child care centers closed, but as you were mentioning, many of the women who were able to keep their jobs didn't have child care services. They desperately needed those child care services in order to work from home. So it really created a really desperate situation where it was almost impossible for women to work at home and provide child care services to their family at the same time.
Absolutely. And it points to a lot of structural issues in our communities and in our economy that when, you know, you ask Carrie the question about why do we think most of the service jobs in Vermont are held by women? And I think the point that those jobs tend to have much more flexible hours is a really important point. And so women are more likely to accept jobs that have that flexibility because other jobs do not provide that flexibility. And so when we're looking towards solutions on the other side of this pandemic, as we're sort of restructuring an economy that we shut down, we can look to that flexibility of jobs as a really important step in making sure women have economic parity.
Carrie, I got this email from Sue in Underhill who wrote, I own a small residential cleaning business and work primarily locally. Before COVID-19, I thought I could maintain my business and expand it as needed to meet our family's financial needs. Well, now I'm on the other side of that COVID line and my business has become obsolete due to families being home and their financial impact as well, not to mention the jeopardy of entering somebody else's home to clean it. I thought you might want to hear the impact from a small local business, Sue writes. I don't employ anyone but myself, which leaves us vulnerable. My income helps support a household of 5 adults, 3 who are unable to work due to health issues. I'm not asking for a handout, but I am saying if I'm not able to work, what can I do? If the government, both the state and federal, shut down business, don't they have a responsibility to support these businesses in the long term? Carrie, what would you say to Sue?
Well, as a matter of fact, on Friday night, the Vermont legislature passed a bill that will provide economic recovery grants to businesses in Vermont. And there is a set aside in that bill of $5.5 million for small women-owned and minority-owned businesses. And so that's something that is on the horizon coming up pretty soon. That is a form of help to recognize the impact on businesses such as Sue's, where they don't have any employees and they've seen a significant downturn in their business. So, you know, there's a lot of money that's coming out from the government right now to help us get through this crisis, which is fantastic. But I think we also need to take a little time now to think about the structural inequities that have made this so much worse for women than it necessarily had to be. And so everyone's having trouble with work and everyone's having trouble with income. But the reasons why it's affecting women so much more is because of those inequities that were in place already. So the kinds of things that we've talked about, including childcare, which is a huge one. The vast majority of childcare workers are women, and so we're impacting their employment, and these are jobs that are extremely low-paying to begin with. So if you're in a very low-paying job, you're less likely to have savings, you're less likely to have benefits that can help you through, and so the impact of businesses shutting down is just felt that much harder.
Let's go to our callers and start today with Ronnie, who's calling from Essex. Hi, Ronnie. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely.
I just wanted to make a note and shine a light on all of the points Carrie is making. I work with Vermont Works for Women. We've had a large increase of women calling in need of our services, and 90 to 95% of those women are all calling with childcare issues. It's across the board, across the state, the number one issue we hear in getting back to work. I think also I want to make a note that it's not only our participants, but it's a huge internal struggle as majority of our staff are struggling with our own home child care struggles and still trying to do the work that's needed the most right now.
Ronnie, thanks very much for your phone call. Emily, when you hear that and you see the commitment that the Vermont legislature tries to make to child care, do you just think that there's so much more that needs to be done?
Yes, that's what I think every day. There is so much more that needs to be done. I think the piece that Terry highlighted about the specific set-aside we have for women and minority-owned businesses is really important to name, because all of the other pieces of business support legislation that have come out at both the federal level and the state level are set up for larger businesses with more consistent flows of income. So when we think about that caller's personal business that is very sort of flexible year to year on how much income she's bringing in, that she doesn't have any employees, she's going to have a much harder time accessing the kind of business supports as a sole proprietor and as someone with a fluctuating cash flow than a larger business that might have a few employees and have a consistent cash flow. And so that puts her at a disadvantage in accessing supports that are on the surface considered universal, but when we dig a little bit deeper, they're not going to support women-owned businesses as much as they're going to support male-owned businesses. And so every time we're developing legislation like this, we really need to take a deeper look to see who's going to benefit and who's not in order to even come close to leveling the playing field so we can have a Vermont that works for all of us.
We're going to go back to our callers and talk to Dr. Joyce Young, who is calling from Sunapee, New Hampshire. Dr. Young, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for taking my call. The inequities with women with children have gone on for a long, long time. I was a single parent in the 1980s with three children. I have two advanced degrees, a bachelor's degree in biology and a master's degree in botany. We needed more money, and I couldn't find a flex-time job even back at that time to meet the needs of the children. So what I ended up doing was to start and run a certified organic farm in western Massachusetts. I farmed 3 acres for 8 years so that I could work my own hours. 20 years ago, I went back to school to get a naturopathic medical degree. But I have had all low-paying jobs all these years. I don't have a pension. I'll be working for the rest of my life. And what I mentioned to your person who took the call was that there's a wonderful book called The Price of Motherhood. Mothers give altruistically, and there is a price to be paid for being a mom.
Dr. Young, thanks very much for your phone call. I heard either Carrie or Emily seemed to indicate that they were aware of that book. Am I right?
I'm not aware of that book, but the concept of the motherhood penalty, I'm very aware of. It is very real that there's a quantifiable cost to having children, and it's really high for women. And that has to do with the fact that women are disproportionately taking care of family and home and doing the labor at home. And, you know, we're seeing that right now nationally. Women are doing about 72 hours of at-home labor every week, and men are doing about 52 hours of at-home labor every week. So that's, you know, 20 hours a week more that women are spending on that as while they're juggling their own jobs. And in normal times, women are four times more likely to take time off when their children are sick. They're much more likely to cite family responsibility as the reasons why they work part-time, and so their earnings are lower. And as our caller said, it's really has a long-term, lifelong impact. And so when we look at senior citizens in Vermont, we see that men have about $11,000 more in income than women do in Vermont, and that's almost twice as much. It's almost twice as much in Social Security benefits, excuse me, overall. It's about $11,000. And so that's because of a lifetime of working the lower paid jobs, working less, not having the job with the pension and the retirement benefits. And then, you know, it becomes something that is very, very hard to catch up on.
Representative Kornheiser, you talked about some structural change, and Carrie mentioned some money in the COVID bill that the legislature just passed. You were part of a coalition of people talking about a fair jobs and recovery plan. What did that entail, and how much of that actually made it into law?
So we know from many conversations that I think we've had across the state that COVID really widened the existing cracks in our communities and helped a lot more of us see where those cracks were, whether that is around caregiving or economic inequality. And so as we rebuild Vermont's economy, the question is, do we want to rebuild it close to the way it was before, or do we want to acknowledge that a lot of what was happening wasn't working for everyone and we need to do things differently? And so this coalition proposal was saying, what if we took this opportunity to incentivize businesses that were going to provide flexible schedules and really work to prevent sexual harassment and have equitable pay across gender lines? What would that look like to have real worker protections for every business in Vermont going forward? And how would that really create a long-term change in our communities? And so some pieces of that proposal made it through. There's always the struggle in the legislature between sort of efficiency and efficacy and really focused solutions. And so what we do have in the existing bill is a set-aside, as Carrie described, that really focuses on what the specific needs of women-owned businesses and minority-owned businesses. We have hazard pay, which made it into the final bill, which acknowledges the nurses and healthcare workers and personal care workers who are disproportionately women who are on the front lines of this pandemic. And there is a little bit in the larger economic development policies and structures that asks businesses to certify that they're in compliance with state laws, and equal pay is one of those state laws. The other piece of the package that I want to talk about, which I think is really important, is how state benefits are delivered. So most state benefits, whether that is food stamps, EBT, or unemployment insurance, or really anything, it's something that people need to apply for, they need to opt into. And there's a big barrier to participation, both because of pride and sort of New England cultural mores, as well as it's really difficult, annoying paperwork, to be quite honest. And there's a lot of hoops to jump through, and people don't really have time to jump through hoops when they're trying to care for four children who are all home from school that they're supposed to be homeschooling. And so we've had a few programs during the pandemic that are really much more of an opt-out program, and that's been a big difference for families. And so we've had schools delivering daily lunches every day. We've had food stamp EBT cards that go to every household in a community that have children. So people don't have to say, I'm needy, I want food stamps. Everyone gets them and can use them as they wish. And so when we move towards solutions like that, it makes a real difference for families' ability to make it work, and particularly for women's ability to make it work as members of those families.
Carrie, would you agree that in a way there's an opportunity now with what's going on economically with the pandemic, that there's an opportunity to restructure things along the lines that Emily was talking about?
Absolutely. And I think that's one of the things we really have to keep our eyes on is as we're, it's one thing to just get through a crisis, but now is a time when we can think about, as Emily said, some things that we're doing differently during the crisis because of it, maybe things we want to continue doing. And then there's also a chance for us to think about structurally how this can be different. And incentivizing businesses to provide more flexible hours, to provide predictable schedules, that's a huge problem for people working in jobs such as restaurants where they don't necessarily know what their schedules are going to be. Those are just some examples of changes that we can make right now.
Child Let's go back to our...
One, actually, sorry.
Okay, no.
Yeah, child care. Lots of people are talking about child care and recognizing that it was an unsustainable system before all this started. And now we can just see so clearly the crisis that child care is in. And so when we come back out of this, we don't want to just go right back to the same problems that we had. So we need further investments in child care.
And Carrie, is one of the problems... Go ahead, Emily.
Thank you. Sorry about that. When we think about child care workers, at the beginning of this pandemic, we had flyovers celebrating our essential workers. We had, you know, parades in the street and folks just being so proud of their fellow community members that were working these frontline jobs. And these are jobs that have gone, you know, low paid, low benefit, low rights for a very long time. And so this is our opportunity as we sort of come out of this pandemic to put our money where our mouths are and say, if these are essential jobs to keep our entire communities and economies flowing, then we need to actually treat these folks well.
And so the problem, Emily, in part, I hope this doesn't simplify it too much, but if we pay childcare workers a small amount of money, we're not going to attract a lot of people into this field. And the ones that we do attract tend to be women who don't have other more flexible job opportunities. And so the pay really does make a huge amount of difference in terms of the success and the quality of childcare. Do you think that's true?
I think it's a three-legged stool. And so when you have low-paying jobs, it's really hard to incentivize folks or for folks to have any motivation to seek further education in their field if they're not going to, if they're going to have to be paying back student loans, if they're going to be having to, you know, work a job while in school. So if the pay doesn't match what the ask is in that job, it's really hard for folks to have a desire to move into that field. So we do. We have a shortage of work. We have a shortage in that workforce, even though it's a very skilled workforce. The cost for families is too high right now. And so we're having this sort of described as this, it becomes a difficult bargain between raising the wages of the child care, early care and education workforce and paying more for families. But there's actually a third option in there, which is state and federal funding for these and really recognizing that this is a public good, much like K-12 education, where we know that our teachers are paid well, have good benefits and a good education, and families feel safe and secure investing in that public education. And so it takes a little bit of a mind shift to say there, it doesn't have to be this bargain between parents and providers. There's the third option where government really joins the conversation and provides.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Jackie, who's calling from Brattleboro. Hi, Jackie. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thanks for talking about this particular subject. It's really very helpful to hear that you're concerned about it. I'm an old woman. I'm close to 70 here in Brattleboro, and I worked in a local hotel. which, you know, has been shut down, and the guests are trickling back in. I don't know that I'm going to get back into that job. And at my age, I don't know that I'm going to be able to find another job. I'm concerned. I mean, I already work two jobs. I have that job, and then I have rental property. But my rental property is also, you know, it's on Airbnb, and so that's been limited. So I am very scared about what's going to happen when the unemployment and the extra $600 runs out. I don't know what I'm going to do.
Carrie, do you have any advice for Jackie?
Well, yeah. I mean, this is exactly the kind of thing we were talking about before, where people are seeing their jobs shut down, and then when they're looking at the recovery and coming out of this, it's looking like it's going to be extra slow because it's, you know, lodging and food service, and there's just not going to bounce back. And so this is where I think we have to continue looking longer term and not just at the crisis management. And I know that the legislature is starting to look at that, and Emily has a lot of great ideas, and the Women's Caucus has been working on this as well. But it's a huge challenge.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Dan in Newfane. Hi, Dan.
Hi.
Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thanks for having me. You know, sure. I think that the thing we haven't mentioned, that you folks haven't mentioned, which is really the elephant in the room, is sexism. We are a male supremacist society, just like we're a white supremacist society, and we have never, ever valued the jobs that women did. We don't value childcare. We don't value teachers, especially elementary school teachers. We have this great myth of, like, we love our children and we love our families, and yet the people that are the most important to take care of those supposedly most important aspects of our society are the least paid, the most poorly treated. It's, you know, Black Americans and women have never, ever had any chance at being treated anything close to equally. And until we understand that and change it, none of these things are going to change.
Dan, thanks for your perspective. Emily, what are your thoughts about that?
I absolutely agree. I don't think that, I think it's really important whether we're talking about Black lives or women's lives or queer people's lives, that we don't expect that every single person needs to overcome their implicit bias before we can have structural change in the system. Structural change can be led rather than follow cultural change. And so we can put a lot of systems in place so that folks who might experience implicit bias can be more protected from it. And one of those places is making sure that our labor laws are really up to snuff and followed throughout the state. And so that's looking at things around flexible schedules, and like Carrie said, permanent reliable schedules is a really another important aspect of that. Making sure that when hiring, we're not asking about past salary history. That's another way we really reinforce structural economic differences. And the power of unions. When we look at sectors that are traditionally female sectors that have managed to move into decent pay scales, that is teachers and nurses, and those are sectors with very, very strong union involvement and a strong labor history. And so the more we can become communities and a politic that supports the role of working Vermonters and unions, I think the better place we'll be in to really advocate for the structural needs of women and people of color.
And Carrie, what are your thoughts that Dan mentioned to us that our society doesn't value the jobs that women traditionally are employed at? So because there's not being that kind of value attached to those jobs, there are all these disparities that we've been talking about today.
Yep, that is absolutely true. Unfortunately, sexism and bias are at the heart of a lot of this. You know, I don't think it's a coincidence that some of the lowest paying jobs are caregiving jobs, which are traditionally held by women. And, you know, that's a big part of the wage gap that we see in Vermont and around the country. There's a lot of evidence that when
a traditionally female job starts having more men come into it, the pay goes up. And vice versa, traditionally male job, more women come in, the pay starts to go down for everybody. So, yeah, absolutely, this is at play, and we do need to wrestle with this.
Carrie, the report also looks at child abuse, sexual abuse, domestic violence during the pandemic, and it seems to raise a lot of concerns there.
Yeah, exactly. So women are already at much more risk of domestic and sexual violence. And there was a lot of fear. There is a lot of concern about when you shut down jobs and ask everyone to stay at home, that you're putting women who are already at risk of violence in their home at much, much greater risk. And we've seen this in other kinds of cases of mass disasters, that the rates of domestic and sexual violence go up. And this is also, again, one of those things that's likely to continue on for quite a while and have a longer-term impact, even as people start going back to work. The stress that this is putting families under and the lack of safety is just going to continue. So we're very concerned about that. As far as the child abuse calls, one of the things that we've been seeing in the first part of this shutdown, at any rate, was that when people make calls to DCS saying, "I'm worried there's some abuse happening," they will give reasons why they said that. And the domestic violence in the home, given as a reason, has gone way, way up from where it has been in the past. And so, you know, even if there are people are having a hard time kind of getting out of their home to be able to access resources, it's still being noticed, and other people are trying to help as they can. So that's a big concern.
And Emily, there are some startling economic statistics included in this report. One that really caught my eye is that 47% of Vermont households that are headed by women with minor children under the age of 5, so that's 40% of those households, are in poverty, whereas just 14% of the households headed by men with minor children live in poverty. That is an enormous difference.
And there's a wide range of reasons for that, the biggest one being what we've talked about, that we have an enormous pay gap according to gender. And so women are making less. We've also seen some research to point to the fact that single fathers are held up as heroes in some cases culturally, whereas single mothers are vilified and judged. And so some of that implicit bias that an earlier caller talked about plays out there. And then we also know that for those women who are single heads of households making less money, we have in recent legislation expanded some of the safety nets that would support folks. I talked about increased access to food benefits. We're also increasing extra funding connected to folks who are on REACH-UP, which is our state's welfare program. And then another piece, which I think is really important and ties into both the issue of single mothers and the issue of intimate partner violence, is housing insecurity and how with a very limited income, it becomes very, very difficult for people to find and maintain stable housing, as well as if they need to leave a house where they feel unsafe because of their partner's behavior, they don't have very many options to turn to. And so in many areas of our state, housing is well above what someone making minimum wage could possibly afford. And so that really exacerbates all of the other issues.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Lori in Montpelier. Hi, Lori. Welcome to the program.
Oh, hi. Thank you for taking me.
Sure. What's on your mind today, Lori?
Okay, well, I was a single mother, and with a master's degree in public health and toxicology, but I had to take an administrative low-paid job part-time to, correspond with taking care of my daughter. When my child graduated, I couldn't get back into my profession, so, I've continued working like that. Because of the pandemic, I lost that job temporarily because my employer, you know, wasn't making enough business to keep me employed. When I applied for unemployment, I guess I was denied. I got paperwork that said I had zero benefits, but I never could get an explanation of why. And I figured that it's because I'm making less than what you, the minimum that you need to make to get unemployment, which is ridiculous because, the amount that I was making was paying for my rent. And without it, I'm in, you know, real bad financial, stress. And it just doesn't make sense that you have to make a lot of money to get unemployment, whereas people who are not making very much are the ones who are more stressed financially.
Lori, your story does, I agree with you, it does not make sense. Carrie, can you shed any light on this, on how unemployment works?
I am not an expert on how unemployment works. I can tell you we've gotten a lot of phone calls in our office from women who are having a hard time navigating the system. I'm sure that Emily has as well. I know that all legislators have been taking these calls and trying to help people navigate the system. It's been much more challenging than it seems like it should be. And we are also very, very worried about what's going to happen when this extra $600 for those who are receiving unemployment runs out. And even though conditions haven't really changed that much in terms of employment.
And Carrie, when does that money run out? Does that run out in a couple of weeks or even sooner?
It's the end of July, I believe.
So it would take an act of Congress to renew that past the end of July.
Right.
And right now Congress is, I think, on a summer break. Yes, Emily.
Can I jump in here? Because I want to make sure that Lori and any listeners in a similar situation to Lori can find a path to a little bit of benefits here. So we know that we've talked about how folks who provide care aren't valued by our communities. And we also know our economy. We also know that people who ask for care are not necessarily supported by our communities. And so we have these benefit systems like unemployment insurance that are designed to their primary role in the system design is to prevent fraud rather than to provide care. And so what we saw with our unemployment insurance is denials were sent out without real explanation of what someone's next step would look like. And so in Lori's case, yes, there are some folks who don't make enough to qualify for regular unemployment, but you're eligible for pandemic unemployment assistance, which you can also apply for on the Department of Labor's website, or by calling your local Department of Labor and they can talk you through it, or you can call your local legislator and they will talk you through how to do that. So there's a separate parallel system that's set up for folks who don't qualify for regular unemployment insurance. But because our system isn't designed to provide care, it's designed to prevent fraud, we aren't giving the kind of information to people that they really need to get their needs met.
Emily, it's very good information.
And that's one of the things that needs to change. Yeah.
Yeah, it's very good information for our listeners to know. Let's go back to our callers and talk to Lisa in Stowe. Hi, Lisa. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Bob. Thanks for taking the call. Full disclosure, I'm also a member of the Commission on Women. My personal experience has been as someone who has been able to work from home telecommuting since my children were very small, who are now in college. And I hope we're now turning a corner where more people are going to be able to telecommute. It's great flexibility for women, but there are going to be a lot of women who are left out and all people if Vermont does not get high-speed internet to every corner and every last mile in Vermont. So I'm interested to hear what can be done, what is being talked about for finally getting internet access for everyone in the state.
Okay, Lisa, that's a great question. Emily, I think there was part of this COVID-19 pandemic economic development legislation that just passed both the Vermont Senate and Vermont House that addresses this issue to some degree, doesn't it?
There is absolutely some degree that we're meeting this need. So all of the funding for the COVID relief funds that we got from the feds needs to be spent by December 30th of this year. And so full-scale rollout of broadband could not happen in that time. But what we are doing is funding last mile projects, and that will be prioritized to folks who need it for educational, so basically families with children, or health needs. And so that's going to go a pretty long way on our connectivity. And then there's some other stuff in there to support communications union districts and some really great legislation that we passed earlier in the biennium around connectivity. One of my concerns, Lisa, is that as I've been working from home with my family all around me, with both my regular job and my legislative job, I've found that the call to caretake during my workday is a much stronger call than it would be if I was working outside of the home. And so that trap that we can do it all, which I think women have been falling into and trapped into for perhaps since the beginning of time, becomes even stronger when we're working from home. And so I worry about how that will impact women both economically and socially as we think that we can both do all the caretaking and all the working all in one place.
Carrie, we've been talking about the possibility and the opportunity to restructure Vermont economy to make it more equitable going forward in the future. If you could point to one or two things that could be done, would they come from the legislature? What would they be? If you could wave that magic wand and say, you know what, this would make an enormous amount of difference.
Yeah, well, it would have to be a very, very magic wand because a lot of it is really about cultural change. And, you know, we've been talking about the way that women are taking on much more of a caretaking role than men do. And Emily made a great, great point. That's absolutely happening, and it's definitely something to watch out for. So we really need a shift any policies that we put in place that are designed to help working mothers, we have to make sure that they're also going to be supporting working fathers in taking care of their home responsibilities. So paid family and medical leave that is fully and equally available to both mothers and fathers could go a long way towards helping nudge that cultural shift along. Increased investments in childcare, as I talked about before, and just looking at flexible schedules and predictable, reliable scheduling could also have a huge, huge impact.
Emily, you know the workings of the legislature. You just came through a pretty unique session that was done primarily, at least for the last couple of months, by Zoom. You heard people on the Appropriations Committee talking about the lack of revenue over this time period and how the state is going to have to try to use some federal funds to backfill the lost state revenues. For something like childcare, it would seem like state support, financial support for childcare would be a very important component of what you hope to have happen. How do you convince members of the legislature that in tough economic times, that this is a important investment for them to make?
I'm hoping that one of my roles in the legislature can be around a culture shift towards data-driven decision-making. We have seen so much evidence by economists across the globe about investing during times of economic downturn and the value of doing that, that austerity begets austerity and prosperity begets prosperity. And so now more than ever is when we actually need to invest in our communities with state dollars. And especially for investments like childcare that we know actually save money within 5 years. And so if we can really think across biennium, even just across two or three biennium when we're making investments, we know that we'll save money down the line that we can then invest in something else.
If you'd like to see the complete dashboard from this report from the Vermont Commission on Women, you can do so by going to women.vermont.gov. That's women.vermont.gov. Many thanks to our guest today, Carrie Brown, who is the executive director of the Vermont Commission on Women, and also Emily Kornheiser, who is a member of the commission and a state representative from Brattleboro. Carrie and Emily, thank you very much for taking the time to be with us today.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.